Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book on some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. For this episode, we have two returning guests, historians Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith. They are the co-authors of a compelling new book on two of the most fascinating figures in American history of the early 1960s. Their book is titled Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, published by Basic Books in 2016. In its first weeks of release, this book has earned praise from reviewers, and it is a must-read for those who are interested not only in the two main subjects, but also in the broader history of civil rights in America and the history of boxing, sports, and politics. Here's our interview. On the line from Atlanta, where he teaches at Georgia Tech, is Johnny Smith. Johnny, welcome to New Books in Sports.
Thanks for having me, Bruce. Excited to talk to you.
And we also have Randy Roberts, who is Distinguished Professor of History at Purdue University. Randy, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Bruce. It's good to be here.
And Randy, so it's been a while since you've been a guest on the podcast. We spoke about, 4 years back about your biography of Joe Louis, and then again about your book on the great Army football teams of the 1940s. And in the meantime, since your last appearance, then you also had another book on Bear Bryant and Alabama football, correct?
Yeah, you missed it. I felt lonely.
Well, you know what? I'm sorry, Randy. It would really be a stretch for me to do an episode on Alabama football. I would really have to swallow hard to do that.
Oh, come on. You kind of love the Tide.
Oh, man. Okay. And so, Johnny, you were on 2 years ago. We talked about your book on John Wooden and the UCLA basketball teams of the 60s and 70s. And at that time, when I asked you at the end of the interview, what was your next project? You mentioned this book on Muhammad Ali. So this has been in the work for how long? At least 2 years then.
Yeah, we had discussed the idea of writing a biography when I was finishing up the UCLA book. And one of the things that Randy and I kept returning to was that, you know, writing a biography of Ali would be interesting, but no one had really explored how Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali. And we wanted to go back and look at his life in depth in the period between 1962 and 1965, the period of time that framed his relationship with Malcolm X. And we were really glad that we did that.
So you were starting out with this book project. You were deliberate in terms of setting the goal of writing a different kind of Muhammad Ali book, because there are plenty of Muhammad Ali books.
Well, you know, we started off initially thinking that we would do a full biography, because there's really not a full, heavily researched academic, if you want to call it academic slash, you know, well-written biography of Muhammad Ali. Still the best biography is probably Tom Hauser's oral biography, which is, you know, as an oral biography, it's just spectacular. But it's not the same thing that historians would do. So we thought about that. But the more, as Johnny said, the more we started doing research, we started to feel like, you know, this is the most interesting period. This is a period between the Olympics and him winning the title, and particularly then the assassination of Malcolm X. This is when it all happens. This is who we know today Muhammad Ali was formed.
And Randy, I'll ask you, so you've written biographies of Joe Louis, as we mentioned, Jack Dempsey, Jack Johnson, and so these are three iconic heavyweight champions. Were you always thinking throughout your career that you'd like to do a book about Ali, or were you wary of Ali as a subject?
No, I was always thinking about it, particularly if you look at the three kind of great black iconic champions of the 20th century, Jack Johnson, Joe Louis, and Muhammad Ali. I'd always thought about Muhammad Ali, and I'm a few years older than Johnny, and so I actually lived through the age of Muhammad Ali. You know, everybody talks about their heavyweight champion. Okay, you know, people from the 20s talked about Jack Dempsey, or people from the 30s and the 40s talked about Joe Louis. Well, I'm a product of the 60s and 70s, and my heavyweight champion in all ways was always Muhammad Ali. I don't know, Johnny, who's your heavyweight champion? Mike Tyson?
I'm not claiming Mike Tyson, but, you know, the interesting thing is, unlike Randy, I didn't grow up following boxing the way that he did. And for me, I came to Muhammad Ali going back to when I was an undergraduate, and I took a research seminar course at Michigan State, and we had to write a paper in African-American history, and I was really interested in sports. I thought, you know, I'd like to learn more about Muhammad Ali. He seems fascinating. And so going back to that time, I really came to history through sports and my interest in Muhammad Ali. And so I was really excited to kind of return to this idea of how did Cassius Clay become Muhammad Ali. And I think one of the things that's fascinating about Ali is that this is a man who didn't just reflect his times during the 1960s, but he shaped debates about race, religion, the Vietnam War. And so he was at the center of all of these political conversations, and he was a controversial figure. And, you know, we wanted to explore how did that happen.
Yeah, and if I can just add something to that, you know, that's the great thing about heavyweight champions. What Johnny said is absolutely true for Muhammad Ali, that he shaped the debate. Well, the same thing is true for Joe Louis, that he shaped a debate. The same thing is true with Jack Johnson, that he shaped his debate. These heavyweight champions somehow become kind of lightning rods for American society. Eldridge Cleaver one time said that boxing is a two-fisted testing ground of masculinity in America, and the heavyweight champion as a symbol is a real Mr. America. And I think that both Johnny and I probably believe this. This is accurate. And somehow they seem to incorporate the dynamics, the energy of a period.
Johnny, let me ask you, because I was actually thinking of this question, as Randy said, he's a little older than you, and he, you know, many of these events are in his memory. Did you have instances as you were writing the book and researching where Randy said, no, I remember it was like this, and you had to come back, no, this is what we're finding in the sources? Was there a tension between history and memory in the writing of this book?
Never, actually. I think, to Randy's credit, he came at this subject like he would any other subject, whether he lived through it or not. I think the really fun part of this book was the collaboration. And so, you know, one of the things that Randy and I did is we went on every research trip together. We outlined the chapters together. We had conversations about, you know, how we were going to organize the chapters, how we were going to write the transitions. And we had duplicate copies of every single source. We're talking about thousands of pages of material, FBI files, Malcolm X's papers, the papers of Alex Haley, the Nation of Islam's newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, and dozens of other newspapers as well, especially the papers in New York where Malcolm and young Cassius Clay spent so much time together. And so we were always, you know, pulling out the same source and looking at them together, even if we weren't in the same room. We could talk about these things over the phone, and that was exciting. That was fun. That's what I think really energized the both of us, is that when we would each get excited about something, looking at a source or having a conversation about how to construct a storyline, we were doing it by looking at the same sources.
The only difference is Johnny could locate the sources way faster than I could locate the sources.
And I will add, so after Johnny talks about this real collaborative work, that Johnny, you were once Randy's student.
That's right. I was. You know, I remember when I was still at Purdue, we were always talking about what would make a really good biography. And that's when we started the Ali conversation.
Oh, interesting.
As Randy mentioned before, the fact that there wasn't a really serious, thorough biography of Ali was just stunning to us. And so, you know, even then we were talking about this gap in the literature. And, you know, so the seeds of this project went back to the time when we were together at Purdue. But then after I left and I was finishing up the UCLA book, you know, we kept coming back to this idea of writing about Ali.
Yeah, I think that with all my graduate students, and Johnny in particular, but although I've had some really spectacular
I've interviewed a bunch of your students, so yeah, you've had some pretty
great scholars. I don't want to say Johnny in particular, although Johnny's spectacular, but so is Aaron Guzzuzzi, and so is David Wilkie, so are, you know, and I could go on. But, you know, Johnny and I particularly would talk a lot about books, and I do this with all graduate students. So, and it's just, it's because it's what we do, it's who we are, it's the profession we're in. Okay, what would be a good book? And from the very beginning, I think Johnny would probably agree with this. You know, I try to get graduate students to think about writing books, not writing a dissertation, not writing papers, but writing books, and books that other people would like to read. Aaron Guzzuzzian one time, he commented, and he said it publicly, and I didn't even remember the conversation, but his first book was on Sidney Poitier, and he came to me one time, and he said, you know, that would make a good book, and he gave some instances why it would make a good book. I said, yeah, it would. Why don't you write it? And it was the first time he said that he ever thought that, yeah, why don't I write it? But I'm sure Johnny had the same experience, for some reason, Johnny and I just talked a whole lot more, I think, than I talked with other graduate students.
Randy was a great mentor, without a doubt. Going to Purdue was the best decision I could have made for my career because I was learning from someone who did what I wanted to do. And so I benefited in all sorts of ways of learning about how to conduct research, how to write a book. And I think, you know, with my first book on the UCLA dynasty and John Wooden and the politics of the 60s and 70s, a colleague had once said to me, you know, you can see Randy's imprint on the Sons of Westwood. And I took that as a compliment because it meant that I absorbed a lot of what he had taught me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask about that then. You've both written biographies before. So, Johnny, your book about UCLA basketball really has John Wooden's life at its center. So you've done biographical research. What new challenges did you find in writing about these two subjects who are as well known and as well studied as Ali and Malcolm X?
Well, I think with this book, it was challenging in the sense because I think there are myths about their relationship. You know, if you read Manning Marrable's biography of Malcolm X, Cassius Clay is kind of a transitory figure in Malcolm's life. And what we wanted to show, or what the sources showed, is that, you know, Cassius Clay was more important to Malcolm X at a moment in which Malcolm's life is in danger, at a moment in which Malcolm is in exile from the Nation of Islam. He's been suspended by the nation's leader, Elijah Muhammad, and he's not sure what the future holds. And so he attaches himself to Cassius Clay at a crucial point in his life. And we knew that this was something that hadn't been shared before, and so we were excited about the opportunity to say something new about Malcolm's relationship with Clay. On the flip side, we also thought that no one had really explored in depth the impact that Malcolm had on the political attitudes and the religious beliefs that Cassius Clay had and how he evolved into the man who would become Muhammad Ali. And so, you know, we really felt that our sources allowed us to go in a direction that no other biographer or no other writer had to date.
You know, it was interesting writing this book because one of the books we had to come to terms with is the autobiography of Malcolm X, which presents all kinds of problematic issues. I mean, to begin with, it is an absolutely brilliant, riveting autobiography. Okay, I think anybody who's read it would agree with that. However, it's not really an autobiography. I mean, it's not a book that Malcolm X wrote. Malcolm X told his story to Alex Haley, and Alex Haley wrote the book. And after Malcolm died, the book was changed a little bit and shaped, and there was an agenda by Alex Haley. He had an agenda. And so, you know, if you think about dealing with that book as a historian, and that book becomes very important to us, if you think about that book, it's an autobiography written by somebody else other than who it's purportedly by, who has a particular agenda, and the main person has already died. So, I mean, I think it raises some really interesting historical questions. Do you agree, Johnny?
Absolutely. I mean, if you read David Remnick's book and other books that have explored Muhammad Ali and Malcolm's relationship, they all rely on the autobiography. And there's some parts of the autobiography that can be easily verified, that can be confirmed. But as Randy suggests, there are some other parts that raise questions that you can see in the epilogue of the autobiography, for instance. Alex Haley gets some of his chronology wrong. He makes some mistakes. And it's pretty clear that he stretches the truth in some instances as well, which we wrote about. That was probably, as Randy said, the source that we had to confront in terms of the story, because what's happened is that other writers have used the autobiography and told and retold the same stories using the autobiography, and that's where the myth-making around the relationship between Clay and Malcolm really took shape.
Randy, I want to ask you a question about source material. And I remember when we spoke about your Joe Lewis book, you noted that there were very few sources with Joe Lewis's recorded words, whether something he wrote himself or others writing down what he had said. So how was it to go from writing a biography of a person whose voice appeared only rarely in the book to going to Ali, who never stopped talking?
Right, and Malcolm X.
And Malcolm X.
It's night and day. One of the things, and Johnny was so good at collecting these things, is, you know, we, just using YouTube and other sources, I mean, we were able to get so many speeches, so many interviews, and so their voices, his voice, Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Cassius Clay, their voices became part of my daily life. I could hear it in my sleep. And listening to the voice, what we were able to find is suddenly we could hear the changes in Cassius Clay's voice. Suddenly his words that he was picking are really Malcolm's words, and the expressions that he uses are from Malcolm, and we had heard him before. We had heard Malcolm say this or this sentence or that sentence, and we can hear how Cassius Clay kind of almost the voice of Malcolm inhabits him. And so for that reason, it was a study that was utterly fascinating.
So listening to his audible voice, listening to a recording as opposed to seeing the words in print.
I always think it's better because you can hear how he emphasizes the words.
Interesting.
You can hear how what he's trying. Is he serious? Is he saying in a mocking way? Yeah, it's to listen to a person's voice is always better than reading it on a flat page. It comes to life, and particularly the voices of Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, and Malcolm X. I mean, because they were masters at using their voice and throwing their voice and expressing sarcasm or rage or what have you.
Let me ask, so Johnny, you mentioned earlier that you both brought some new sources into this study of Ali and Malcolm X, and you both mentioned that sources such as the autobiography of Malcolm X have been used extensively and in some ways, I don't want to say misused, but that subsequent authors have picked up on what Alex Haley put into the book, which may or may not be accurate, and then have continued with those stories. So let me ask, what other sources did you bring to the study to say bracket the more familiar sources like Alex Haley's book?
Well, what was essential to begin with was to create a day-by-day chronology of the movements of Cassius Clay and Malcolm X. And this was important because for much of their relationship, from the time they met in 1962 until the Sonny Liston fight against Clay in Miami in February of 64, the relationship was clandestine. You know, the public didn't grasp or know that they were meeting together in private. So one of the things we wanted to establish was, when were they in the same place at the same time? So we began by collecting newspaper material, and we put this chronology together that put Malcolm in this city and Clay in this city, and then they were together in this city at this date. And so the newspaper coverage day by day. And so that was the first key source in helping us recreate the chronology and the movements of both men. Then what we did is, once we had the chronology pretty much set, we looked at Malcolm's FBI files and the FBI files of other other figures in the Nation of Islam, because that then gave us an insider's view of what was happening inside Malcolm's mosque in Harlem, inside the Nation's headquarters in Chicago, and it helped us read the movements of Malcolm and Clay in a way that no other historian or biographer has in the past. And that was critical, because now when you're reading a partially redacted transcript of a phone conversation, we knew clearly they were referencing Malcolm or Clay in a specific instance, and so it raised all sorts of new evidence about what was happening between them in private and how the FBI was tracking their movements. And then the other source I talk about, beyond just interviews and videos and speeches that Randy referenced earlier, was in the spring of 1964, Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X both went on a trip to Africa and the Middle East. They did not go together, as many people know. They would have their last confrontation, their last meeting in Accra, Ghana in May of 1964. But Randy and I explored State Department records that no one had looked at. And this was especially important for understanding how Muhammad Ali had become this symbol of Pan-Africanism, black nationalism, anti-American defiance, and for the first time the government sees him as a threat to its foreign policy goals in that region of the world.
Johnny has heard me say this before. I still think there's some records about what took place in Ghana that we never could find. We looked for these things, and I know they're there. I know someplace. I don't know what happened to them, but there should be some good records out there. The other thing is there was a guy by the name of Jack Olson who wrote a book early on in the mid-60s about Muhammad Ali, and it came out as a series of articles first in Sports Illustrated. Well, he had done a significant amount of interviews in that 65-66 period, so very close to the period that we studied. Interviews with Muhammad Ali, with his father, his mother, his people in his entourage, and we were able to find those interviews. They have been since deposited in a library, and they were helpful because we were able to get, it was almost as if we could go back and interview Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali by this time, Muhammad Ali and the figures around him at that time, instead of interviewing him today, 50 years, 60 years later, whatever it is, 40 years later, we were able to get close to him at the moment that we were writing about. And I found that was really helpful.
Johnny, so on this topic that you mentioned, or this approach you took of plotting out Ali's and Malcolm X's activities day by day, you discuss this in the preface to the book, and you don't say this explicitly, but something that comes out of the preface is this idea that in order to get the broad interpretive arc correct in looking at these two people and their relationship in this period, you have to excavate the details and get those correct. Is that the approach that you were taking?
Yeah. I mean, there was a real challenge. We have to remember that Malcolm X is always on the move. You know, he was preaching out of his mosque in Harlem, but by 1962, 1963, he is traveling to Detroit, to Chicago, Philadelphia. He's visiting other mosques, Washington, D.C. He's giving speeches. He's going on college campuses and debating Bayard Rustin and other civil rights leaders. He's appearing on television and radio shows, and so he's always on the move. And what's happening is that there's a friction that's developing inside the Nation of Islam that becomes very important in understanding the relationship between Cassius Clay and Malcolm X. What happens is that by 1963, Malcolm X is having this crisis of faith. He learns that Elijah Muhammad has been carrying on these extramarital affairs, and he has had children out of wedlock. And so now Malcolm is questioning this idea that Elijah Muhammad is in fact the messenger of Allah. And so his whole world has been shattered. The other thing that's happening is that Elijah Muhammad had consistently told Malcolm to stand down to not talk about politics as much as Malcolm wanted to. And Malcolm's frustration was that he was being criticized by many African Americans because he would talk about how the Nation of Islam was going to lead a movement that would retaliate against whites, that would use whatever means necessary to defend black communities. And yet Malcolm is seeing that the Nation of Islam under Elijah's leadership is standing on the sidelines. And Malcolm is a man of action. His impulse is to do something, to be confrontational. So he has this religious crisis. He has this political change where he is challenging Elijah's authority because he's speaking out and defying Elijah's orders. And so my point is that increasingly Malcolm is moving away from the Nation of Islam. And ultimately, after Malcolm X is suspended in November of 1963, he realizes his future may not be with the Nation of Islam. And yet he also recognizes at that same time that Cassius Clay, on the verge of fighting against Sonny Liston for the heavyweight championship, may be exactly what he needs in his life to build a new movement.
I think there's so much he was saying there. It's interesting. And one of the issues that Johnny and I talked about, oh God, I can't remember how many times we talked about it, is what was on Malcolm's mind.
Mm-hmm.
When did he realize that there was going to be no going back to Elijah Muhammad? Because we'll see signs of it that, you know, clearly he's ready to break. Clearly he's ready to get Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali to go with him. Okay, he's going to form his new organization. But then we'll see the next day there's a sign that he's holding out hope that maybe it won't be. He won't have to break with Elijah Muhammad. And so he goes back and forth. I don't know if Johnny would agree, but there's probably never a moment that we could absolutely say, aha, here is the time that he finally made up his mind. And to me, that becomes a very human story. This is how we all are. You know, we go back and forth. It's not cut and dry. Sometimes historians make biography seem so certain. Okay, yeah, the person is sure he's moving this way, he turns this way. In point of fact, we waffle all the time.
And that was something striking in those chapters of the book where you were showing Malcolm X's, and as you said, almost on a daily level, is how he was debating back and forth what he was going to do. And at the same time, what was happening with Cassius Clay? Was he also being drawn back and forth between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, or was he moving steadily in one direction?
That's interesting. In some ways, we can see the agony of Malcolm X, a person who I have no question loved Elijah Muhammad, did not want to break with Elijah Muhammad. Elijah Muhammad was the reason that he got out of prison, that he became famous, that he found the cause. I mean, this is a person he deeply reveres, and so we can see the agony. With Muhammad Ali, you can't say it. Okay, it looks as if he's going directly with Malcolm. We can see it all along. Then all of a sudden, he makes the decision and he goes with Elijah. So that going back and forth isn't there with him. The soul searching. I never really saw, and maybe Johnny can change this for me, but I don't know if we ever really saw the same kind of soul searching that Malcolm went through.
I think Randy's right. I mean, it was clearly visible in Malcolm's actions that he was going back and forth about, okay, I've been suspended from the Nation of Islam. Elijah Muhammad is testing me. At first he thinks when this suspension happens on December 1st, 1963, the suspension will be lifted. He's just trying to demonstrate his authority here. I'll be back in the Nation of Islam. But, you know, December passes, January goes on, it's February, and Elijah has not lifted the suspension. And as we get closer to the fight in in Miami between Clay and Liston, that's when Malcolm starts to have some doubts about his future. And he knows, what he does know, is that whether he returns to the Nation of Islam or he is permanently dismissed from the movement, he wants Cassius Clay in his world. And he also knows that Elijah Muhammad is going to want Cassius Clay, the new heavyweight champion, in his world. So Malcolm recognizes that while he's got one foot in the Nation of Islam and one foot out the door, he wants to hold on to Cassius Clay, because Cassius Clay is going to become valuable. Cassius Clay is exactly what Elijah and Malcolm wanted to help build their movements. He was the kind of person who could draw other young, frustrated black men into a movement. He could be someone that they could build thousands of followers around. And so Cassius Clay's value is becoming significantly greater to Malcolm as he's thinking about a life without the Nation of Islam.
And the interesting thing is after Cassius Clay wins the heavyweight title, he defeats Sonny Liston. The night that he defeats him, afterwards he goes to a party, and he's with Malcolm. And Malcolm is happy. He's calling friends back in Harlem and New York. You know, look what my little brother did. Look what the new champion. And he can see, I mean, he is tied to Cassius Clay. I mean, they're joined at the hip. And then he leaves. He goes out of the room for a little time. And Cassius Clay turns to Jimmy Brown, the great football player, and says, you know, I don't think I'll be able to stay with Malcolm. Right. You know, I'm going to have to go with Elijah Muhammad. And it's like, what? Where does that come from? So it becomes a really interesting story. And we go back again to the idea of who is Cassius Clay. And we talk about the different faces of Cassius Clay. You know, we talk about, you know, the Cassius Clay of the Olympic Games, Cassius Marcellus Clay and the Louisville Lip and Cassius X and finally Muhammad Ali. But trying to figure out exactly who he is a pretty difficult chore.
Yeah, yeah. So, and what struck me, so you write about these different masks that Cassius Clay puts on in the early 60s. But what also struck me is that even though he was convincing as he took up these different masks, he also shows himself, I don't know the word to use, as innocent or easily led. Is that a correct view of him during these times? He's young. He's certainly young, and he's pulled in different directions.
Well, I think he recognizes the more time he spends with the Nation of Islam, certainly by 1962, by the spring of 1962, he knows he cannot divulge to the public his involvement with the Nation of Islam. He's aware. He's certainly conscious of the idea that the Nation of Islam is known as a hate cult, as a violent sect. Malcolm X is the most hated black man in America, who he's looked at as a demagogue. So Cassius is shrewd. He knows he can't share his relationship with the ministers in the Nation of Islam. At the same time, he tells reporters that he reads his Bible while he's, you know, in private going to these meetings and learning about Islam. And so, you know, Cassius Clay, you know, he is presenting himself one way in public, and yet at the same time, when he's in these meetings in the Nation of Islam's mosques, he presents himself another way. And I think between 62 and 1964, he is conflicted in some ways. You know, he was raised in the church. His mother had taken him to the Baptist church. And what happens when he goes to the meetings in the Nation of Islam, though, is he questions Christianity. And he questions what he's learned in the church. And what the Muslim ministers are telling him seems to make more sense to him about how the white man's heaven is a black man's hell. That is something that is concrete for him when he looks around America and sees how white people are living and how the majority of black people are living.
Let me make an analogy with Cassius Clay. He loved magic. Okay, you know, mm-hmm. all of his life,
yep,
he loved
yep.
magic. And he would do tricks. And you know, I was actually with Cassius Clay a few times, and I saw him do this. I saw him do tricks for people. And he had a few tricks, you know, prop type of things he would do all the time. Well, the key to magic is you do the trick once, and boom, it's magic. You don't do it again. You don't repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and let people, you know, closely scrutinize you to figure out what the trick is. Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, would do that. He would do the trick, and then he would do it over, and he would do it over, and it would be, and do it over. It was almost as if he was trying to fool you, to trick you, that it was magic. But then he wanted you to see what the truth was.
Oh.
And this is the way he lived his life. You know, he was disguising what he was doing. He wasn't saying he was joining the Nation of Islam. He was keeping an arm's length away from the nation, but yet he would give the nations the patter, the speech, the ideology would all come from him. He would say to somebody, I wonder if there's spaceships up there in the sky, you know, referring to a Nation of Islam belief. And so he's this odd character of hiding his true feelings, but yet trying to reveal his true feelings. And it makes him a really interesting character to study.
So let me ask you, in just talking about Malcolm X and Cassius Clay, we get something of a different interpretation just from what you two have said. Yet in the book, in the preface to the book, you write that your two subjects, Ali and Malcolm X, share the same DNA. What do you mean by that?
I think what we're talking about there is the origins of their frustration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Malcolm's father was a Garveyite, a black nationalist, and Malcolm, when he was a little boy, heard his father, you know, talking about white supremacy and this outrage. Cassius Clay grows up in a household where his father also is outraged by the fact that the white man holds him down. And so Cassius Clay hears this message over and over again from his father that don't trust the white man. The white man is dangerous. You know, Malcolm's father said the same thing in his household. And so one of the things that we talk about is that the incredible influence their fathers had on both of these young men, that both of them saw their fathers suffer, endure pain from discrimination, from racism in America. And so there's a bond there between Clay and Malcolm, that they both saw the world through the same lens. They both saw the ways in which whites brutalized black Americans and treated them as second-class citizens. And so, you know, as much as Cassius Clay could come off as sweet and funny and innocent, the fact is that the more he spends time with the ministers in the Nation of Islam, he begins to reveal the anger that has been buried beneath the surface, the frustration. And the reality is that after he breaks with Malcolm X, we see it more and more. He's more vengeful. He's more spiteful. He's even ugly in the way that he talks about other black folks. You know, he calls Floyd Patterson an Uncle Tom, and he doesn't hold back in any way. And, you know, that's the way that Malcolm had once spoke before he had gone to Mecca. You know, Malcolm would criticize Martin Luther King and call him an Uncle Tom. And so these are two guys who share the same frustration and anger.
And they're also two that express themselves the same way. They're both incredibly verbal. You know, they're fighters. They're articulate. I mean, there's so much in common between the two. And they'll ultimately follow the same path. They just don't do it exactly the same time.
Johnny, that was striking what you said about the portrait that we get, or the picture that we get of Ali after his break with Malcolm X. As your book closes, the picture that we get of Ali is not, it's definitely not the conventional notion of Muhammad Ali that we have today in American culture. You have a picture of a very different man after Malcolm X's death.
It's one that we often forget. And Randy and I thought that it was important to show how Ali responds in this moment when Malcolm has been murdered in front of his wife and children, and Ali has nothing to say about how it's incredibly sad, how he's grieving this loss. And the irony is, yesterday, April 4th, or the anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination, and I saw someone tweet out a newspaper clipping of how when Martin Luther King was killed, Muhammad Ali didn't want to say a whole lot, he told the reporters, because he didn't want anyone to think that he was making some kind of political statement about his own situation with Vietnam, but that you know, Martin Luther King was a great man, and that he will be missed, and that it was a sad day. You'd never heard anything like that in 1965 when Malcolm X was killed, and Malcolm was far closer to Ali than Martin Luther King was.
Yeah, and a year before, Ali had been was playing with Malcolm's children in Miami, and you know, bouncing them on his knee. You know, but he says nothing. Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon.
I want to ask about the name Muhammad Ali. You point to that Cassius Clay adopting the name Muhammad Ali as really the point at which he breaks from Malcolm X.
Yeah, he was given the name by Elijah Muhammad. And so by accepting the name, you know, he's accepting Elijah Muhammad. You know, he will be Muhammad Ali, Elijah says, as long as he follows Elijah Muhammad, because it's coming with the grace of Elijah Muhammad.
Accepting that name was significant within the Nation of Islam. This was accepting what the black Muslims referred to as your original name. So it was. This was the time in which Cassius Clay rejects his quote-unquote slave name. The ministers in the Nation of Islam taught their followers that your surname is just the name of a white man who owned your ancestors. And so the X that Malcolm had and the other followers of Elijah Muhammad had, it represented a rejection of a heritage tied to slavery, tied to bondage. And then what would happen is, at some point, and it was rare actually, Elijah Muhammad would replace your ex with a original name. And so you would get a name like Shabazz or Muhammad or Ali. And this was considered quite an honor. And at first, Cassius Clay was a little uncomfortable with the idea of accepting a new name for, I think, two reasons. One, he loved his original name. He loved the name Cassius Marcellus Clay. He would go on and on about how it was such a beautiful name. But on another level, he was a little confused by this because there were members in the Nation of Islam who never received their original name. And so he wasn't sure that he deserved it. But this was a political move. Elijah Muhammad knew that if he renamed Cassius Clay, gave him the name Muhammad Ali, it would essentially compel the champ to make a decision. And if he accepted this new name, it would cement Elijah's hold on him. And it meant, too, that when Cassius Clay accepted the name Muhammad Ali, being Muhammad Ali meant being a loyal disciple of Elijah Muhammad. It was no longer possible for him to entertain the idea of being friends with Malcolm X, which is exactly what Elijah wanted.
I do want to ask about boxing, since this is a book about Muhammad Ali. And Randy, you are a historian of boxing. And one of the points that you make in the early chapters is that Cassius Clay saves boxing, that boxing was really in a sorry state in the early 1960s before he enters the scene.
Yes, boxing was assailed from the outside and from the inside. And this is a period of the Kefauver Committee hearings and into professional boxing and the corruption in professional boxing. So there was a sense that fights were fixed. Certainly the Kefauver hearings showed some fights were fixed, particularly the Jake LaMotta, Billy Fox fight. And so here's a fixed fight. This is also the time of the Emil Griffith and Benny Kid Perrette fight, when Benny Kid Perrette died, when Emil Griffith, knocked him out and killed him in the ring. And shortly a year later, the same thing with Sugar Romero and Davey Moore, a championship fight, where Davey Moore, the champion, was killed in the ring. So America was looking at boxing as it's kind of brutal, it's corrupt, it's thuggish. The promoters are crooked. The trainers and managers are exploiting poor, mostly increasingly black fighters. So it's a bad time. And then suddenly, the new heavyweight champion in 1962 becomes Sonny Liston, who represents all of the evils and nefarious activities of boxing. Sonny Liston had spent time in prison. He had been a leg breaker for the mob. He had he was managed. He had his undercover managers were all tied into the corrupt dealings of boxing, and so many Americans were questioning, and not only Americans, Europeans as well. Is boxing a relic of our barbaric past? Is it time to get rid of boxing? So suddenly now, at this moment when boxing is at a low ebb, you get this new fighter, Cassius Marcellus Clay. He's managed by a Lily White, above-the-board management team, the Louisville management team. He was an Olympic champion. He represented his country. He's just gorgeous-looking. He's articulate. He is... he's really the exact opposite of Sonny Liston. People feel, you know, he's exciting, he's interesting, he's controversial. He can't beat Liston, of course, but he revives interest. At a time when boxing is dying, television is leaving boxing. They're canceling weekly fights. Suddenly, when Cassius fights, the crowds turn out. You know, they want to see him. The Doug Jones fight, the Henry Cooper fight in London, all these kind of revive. It's the springtime of boxing.
Well, we're almost out of time, so I want to finish up by asking something that you write in the preface to the book is that your book is an attempt, as you write, quote, to rescue a story that's fallen into the hands of hagiographers. And I want to ask you both, how does this book rescue the story of Ali and Malcolm X from hagiographers?
You know, one thing, if I can say, and it goes back to what you were talking to Johnny about before, you know, the question to ask is, did Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, did he change that much, or did America change that much? You know, partly the way we see him today and the way we see the arc of his career really has to do with his stand in Vietnam, which was unpopular when he took it, when he opposed the Vietnam War and refused to be inducted. But as Vietnam becomes America's bête noire, suddenly we look at Muhammad Ali and we say, you know, here was a prophet. This is what we should have done. This was the movement of America. So in a sense, the politics of America made America, at least liberal America, embrace Muhammad Ali. It's not that he changed radically, although later I think he does change as the Nation of Islam changes, as Wallace Muhammad adopts a more orthodox position.
And I think the other thing, building on everything Randy just said, which I totally agree with, is that in our recent memory, in the last 20 years, there's been a revived interest in Muhammad Ali, but in portraying him as a hero. And that starts with the Olympics in 1996 in Atlanta, mm-hmm. when Muhammad Ali is lighting the cauldron. He's trembling, suffering from Parkinson's. There's a silence. You know, we look at him, and people see him in heroic terms, battling this disease. And in that silence, though, corporate sponsors, movie makers, writers, ESPN, they have crafted an image of Ali as a goodwill ambassador, a hero of all social causes, a man of peace, which he may be some of those things today. However, those same media producers, they have reframed the Ali of the 1960s as a hero then. But the reality is, and I think our book shows this, Ali was not a unifying force of peace and goodwill in the 1960s. He was divisive. He was controversial. He was hated by many Americans. And so what we wanted to do with our book is return to the man in his times, in his moment, and show how he evolved from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, and to introduce readers to a man who was not considered an all-American hero.
And I'll ask, Randy had mentioned at the top of the interview, he had thought of, you both had thought of doing a complete biography of Ali. Would you consider continuing the story forward from this point?
In some way, not as a full biography, though. But, you know, I'd be, there's other points in his life and his conflicts with Joe Frazier, and there's other, I think, really interesting parts that would be interesting to look at, but not as a full life, I don't think.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't want to do a full biography at this point, but I think there are parts of his life in the 1970s that would interest me. You know, the rivalry with Frazier, his fight with Foreman. And I think there's space for that. I think we're going to continue to see more work on Muhammad Ali. I know of some other books by prominent writers that are in the pipeline. And so I look forward to seeing what they have to say.
You've been listening to an interview with Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith about their book, Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, published in 2016 by Basic Books. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like religion, politics, and history. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.